go broader than the endocrine system, but at least it summarizes the endocrine system of the male and the female, trying to understand it. I mean, I hope you get the male, you know, LH, testosterone, negative feedback. FSH, inhibin, negative feedback. That's it, right? Period. With the female, it's more complicated, more fascinating, though. And my goal today is to have all of us understand the menstrual cycle. I think it'll serve you well in medicine. I think if you get it, you got it, and you can think it through. You're not going to forget it, okay? Because it's a beautiful coordinated event that occurs that's so essential for human reproduction. And so let's start like we did the other day. We'll talk about the anatomy first. Here's a similar picture of a female. And like the male, you can see that they show the ovary here. But actually, if you really pass the plane right through the middle of the body, you wouldn't really see the ovary, right? Because the ovary, there are two ovaries. They're each on either side of the midline. But for purposes of illustration, this is drawn here. So let's look at this. So here we have the ovary, okay? We have the fimbriated end of the oviduct, which is this widened end that kind of sweeps over the ovary around the time of ovulation. And there are cilia on those fimbriae, and they sweep the egg into the oviduct. So that's why the egg normally goes into the oviduct. Not always, but most of the time it passes into the oviduct. So here we have the oviduct or fallopian tube. Of course, two oviducts, two ovaries. And then these join the uterus. You can see the uterus is kind of an oval organ that's very muscular. And so most of the, by weight, 90% of the uterus is the myometrium. Myo, you know, muscle, right? When we talk about myo, we're talking about muscle. So the myometrium made a smooth muscle, not skeletal, not cardiac, but smooth. And so this is the organ that has to eventually house the child, the fetus, the embryo of the fetus, has to expand and accommodate and then be able to physically expel the child during the process of labor, right? So it's an organ you don't really need. It's kind of a pain to have in a way because of menstruation and so on. You know, it's only does one thing, really, the uterus. And that's, it's there to bear the child, to bear the young, okay? And so the uterus has a lower end, which is called the cervix. It's a very glandular area. This goes into the vaginal canal here. You could see there are some glands, like the greater vestibular gland here. And then we have the labia minora, labia majora, the inner and outer vaginal lips. Then we have the clitoris. And we also have a deposition of fat here called the mons pubis, pubic symphysis, and the urinary bladder shown here as well with the urethra. And so if we look at this now in a more of a anatomically presented way, you can see that all these organs really are kind of held together. And they're held together by connective tissue. And those connective tissues are ligaments, and there are sheets, like the broad ligament, and there are cylindrical ligaments, like the ovarian ligament here. But really, everything is kind of kept together by these ligaments. And if we look through and we cut through an ovary, we never would see this, okay? Because this is not truly representative of the ovary at any one point in time. It's sort of a compilation that shows you some of the things that happen in the ovary. And this is what we'll be talking about in this first hour today. Here you also have a similar kind of drawing. You can see, again, the broad ligament. Here we have the body of the uterus, the fundus, which is the top of the uterus, the cervix, which is the lower end. You can notice the blood vessels, which course parallel to on either side of the uterus and penetrate into the uterus, and I'll show you more detail on that. We also have the cervix at the lower end, the vagina. Notice the vagina has these kind of ridges on the inner surface, which are the vaginal rugae. And so we have the cervical canal, and we have the vaginal canal. And here you can see the fimbriae here. This area is called the infundibulum, the ampulla, the isthmus, and then the entry point here into the uterus of the fallopian tube. And so if we looked at the fallopian tube in cross-section, you would see it's a very muscular tube, lots of smooth muscle. It also has a lumen, which is hopefully patent all the way through. And this is where the egg would be coming down and the sperm be going up. And so if we looked at the histology of it, you can see that there is an opening here, the lumen. There is a columnar epithelium. And that if you looked really closely at these cells that line the oviduct, these cells are they're mucin-secreting cells, and they have microvilli. So both things are there to help move the two cells closer to each other, but particularly really to move the egg, and if it's fertilized, the conceptus, okay, is another word, to move this down into the uterus. This is a picture of the external genitalia in the female. You can see the urethral opening here, the vaginal entrance here, the vestibule, which is this area, the glands of the clitoris, and the clitoris actually is composed of erectile tissue as it is in the male, but the erectile tissue pass on either side of the vaginal opening underneath the skin. So the clitoris you really see is just the glands, the tip, the head of the clitoris. But the clitoris itself is much larger, and it passes on either side of the vaginal opening. And these are the tissues that become engorged with blood during sexual arousal. We had labia minora, labia majora. Here's the mons pubis I mentioned. Here's the prepuce of the clitoris, the foreskin of the clitoris, the glands. This is a drawing of the ovary, and it kind of starts us off. We don't talk about it, okay, but I want to highlight something on this picture, but we'll get back to the same picture later and talk about the details of what they're really trying to show you, which is folliculogenesis, the process of making a follicle. So notice here that what I wanted to point out here is that the ovary has a cortex, has a medulla, it's got blood vessels that come in and ramify throughout the organ, and it's got a lot of stuff going on, right? And that stuff is what we'll be talking about today. And so getting back to the structural aspects of the uterus, this is a drawing of the blood supply that shows you a little nicer detail the anatomy of the vasculature for the uterus. And again, remember there are two uterine arteries, and these uterine arteries pass on either side of the uterus. They really form a loop. So there's the ovarian artery, which starts at the aorta, kind of comes down, and there is the uterine artery that comes off of the anterior branch of the internal iliac artery, and that comes up, and they anastomose together. So it's really one loop that's got a high pressure head at each end because the aorta and the iliacs are both at systemic pressure, right? And then we have these arteries which emanate from the main uterine artery, which penetrate into the myometrium. Then they encircle the uterus, and these are the arcuate arteries. Then we have smaller radial arteries which penetrate into the inner third of the myometrium, at which point they become kind of coiled. And these coiled terminal portions of the arterial tree are called the spiral arteries. So going from small to big, we have the spiral arteries, the radial arteries, the arcuate arteries, and the main uterine arteries. And this is important because providing enough blood flow to the uterus, but particularly to the placenta once it forms, is essential. And several diseases, such as preeclampsia, are often characterized by an insufficient flow to the placenta. And when you have an insufficient flow into the placenta, you will normally have some limit to the amount of nutrients that are available to the fetus, and therefore you're going to have some growth restrictions. So preeclampsia, not always, but preeclampsia is a very daunting disease, and we're not going to talk much about it. You'll have lectures in generation about it, and we'll see each other in the third year again. But it's a very complicated disease. It's really a syndrome. But some women who are preeclamptic will experience growth restriction in their children, and that's thought to be related to underperfusion of the placenta, okay? And so there's also IUGR, which is intrauterine growth restriction, and that is just a statistical term, really, which means if you have a baby that's a certain amount smaller than the average size of a baby, that baby would be classified as being growth restricted. So babies can be small, babies can be large. So, for example, in gestational diabetes, you've got a lot of glucose, babies keep growing and growing, they have a macrosomia. If a baby's too small, that's called a microsomia. And this is a nice photograph by this lady, Ann Geddes, who's made her career out of photographing babies. And it just shows you, obviously, a baby that's kind of small, right? So, I also shall say, I'm going to post these slides in exchange for the ones you have at the end of this lecture, so you have all these slides. But I went through them, I changed it. You know, I like doing this before I give a lecture. It kind of fires me up for giving a lecture. And then sometimes I can find some mistakes or subtle stuff, something, a better image or whatever. And so there's a few slides you don't have that are in here, but you will have them. Ellen will post them today after the class. So finally, to end with the anatomy, we had the anatomy of the breast, which is required to feed the young by producing milk. And you can see that the breasts are composed of these lobular alveoli that have lactiferous ducts which pass to the nipple, and therefore the child can then suckle on a nipple and have the milk through a process called milk letdown, which we'll talk about tomorrow, which provides the expulsion of the milk so the child can access it. So any questions on the anatomy at all? Okay. So we've talked about spermatogenesis. Oogenesis is very similar to and is very different from spermatogenesis. And so why is it similar? Well, it's similar because the end point is the same, which is that we want to make an egg that has half the normal chromosomes, right? We want to make a haploid cell. That's the purpose. And then we can combine two haploid cells to make a normal diploid cell, right? That's the trick that has to be accomplished. But the timing and the pattern is quite different. And so what normally happens is that in utero, if the child will be a female, that you have a migration of these primary oocytes into the cortex of the ovary. And so they form, and there's maybe, you know, 5, 6, 7 million of these eggs that are there halfway through gestation. So already 20 weeks of gestation, that ovary is just chock full, the cortex is just chock full of oocytes. And so the oocyte is the egg, but as you'll see, the story really involves the follicle. And the follicle is the structure that the egg is within. And so we have the egg, and then we have cells around it. That's the follicle. And so some of these primordial follicles then begin to die off. And this process is a process of attrition. And so by the time a child is born, at birth, maybe only 1 million or 2 remain. Well, only, that's still a lot, right? But you had maybe 6 million. Now you have maybe 2 million, 1 million. If you looked in at the, this is another kind of weird but fascinating thing, is that if you look at the oocyte, when it forms, okay, and then it begins to divide, it stops in the prophase of the first mitotic division. Now, do you all know the sequence of phases in meiosis? You can name them, right? IPMAT, I-P-M-A-T. IP, kind of an awkward word, but IPMAT. Interphase, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. Right? So they stop in the prophase of the first mitotic division, and now they're poised. They're just starting to divide, and they stop. And they stay this way for years and years and years, maybe 50 years in some cases. Okay? And then they will complete the first mitotic division, enter the second mitotic division, stop again, then finish the second mitotic division. And we'll talk about that in detail. So just the message here is that the process of meiosis, unlike the male where you always have this, you know, spermatogonia, primary oocyte, secondary oocyte, here it's kind of very nuanced. It starts, it stops, and then it picks up again, it stops again, and it continues. So this process of attrition, or atresia, or atresia, everything you can say it either way, then continues throughout the woman's reproductive life. And so by the time a child reaches puberty, you know, maybe 400,000 eggs are left, okay? And then of these, maybe 500 will be ovulated, because you usually ovulate one egg per month. If you think of the reproductive life of a woman being 40 years, right? So, I mean, a female goes through puberty around the age of 12, 13, 11, somewhere there. Usually menopause around the age of 50. So let's say 40 years, and you ovulate one egg each month, then that person will have approximately 480 months that will need to be ovulated during. And so only around 500 eggs are needed, okay? But at puberty, maybe 400,000 are there. And then eventually, by the time the woman becomes menopausal, she has very few follicles that are left. And so there's this process of attrition ultimately leads to menopause. This is shown nicely in this picture. The key thing to note on this slide is that the birth is here, you see. And so this is really in utero. And so we have a formation of all these germ cells, these eggs. And then we have a beginning of this attrition process when the number drops, here's puberty, and then continues to drop through life. The chances of a woman getting pregnant also decrease with time. And this is from one study where they looked at the chance of conception any particular month in women from the age of 22 to about 48 or 50. And you can see that, at best, the chance of conception is only 25 or 30%. Okay, you're not going to have 100% chance of conception. It just doesn't happen. But, you know, roughly 25%, let's say. And so if you look at half of 25, 12 and a half here, and you look at the age, well, you can see about the age of 35, 36, the chances of getting pregnant are about half of what they were when this woman was younger. And then it continues to decrease as the woman becomes older. What's interesting is that the problem, maybe not the problem, I think that problem I changed the cause, because it just is, you know, it's not bad, it just is. But the cause is the egg and not the reproductive system. And so this is very interesting, because you can see this on this picture. You can see that the chances, okay, of getting pregnant, or in this case they're expressing it as live births per transfer, okay, you know, around 40%, pretty high, and then decrease down. So by the time you're 40 or 42 or 43, 45, you're approaching zero. Now, if you take eggs from younger women and you put them into women of different ages, then you see the pregnancy rate really doesn't change. And so if you take a 22-year-old's egg and you put it into a 42-year-old woman, she still has exactly the same chance of getting pregnant that she would have had at the age of 20. It's her body still is fine, but it's the egg itself that seems to be diminishing somehow in quality. So the process of oogenesis is shown here. I have two slides, I think, to show this to you. And you can see here we have the oogonia, just like spermatogonia, oogonia. And remember, these are all gone halfway through gestation, right? So all we have now really would be primary oocytes. So all this happens in utero, and it stops about halfway through pregnancy. The primary oocytes poised in that first, you know, prophase of the first mitotic division. And then as it completes the first mitotic division, it extrudes a polar body. So again, unlike the male where you have two cells being formed, you only have one cell being formed. So a lot of energy is put into forming the cell, which is, as you know, is a very large cell. And so we extrude the polar body. This then undergoes a second mitotic division. And here another polar body is extruded as well. And then we finally have the ovum. Now, the second mitotic division is only completed if the egg is fertilized. So the ovum really doesn't exist in a non-fertilized state. It's a secondary oocyte. Okay, the secondary oocyte gets fertilized, and then as soon as the sperm enters the egg, those chromosomes, which are at that point poised in the metaphase of the second mitotic division, complete their second mitotic division. And we'll talk, don't worry if you don't catch all this the first time around. We're going to go through this as we talk about the menstrual cycle. Here's another picture again. Mitosis of oogonium. Notice it says before birth. Primary oocyte, diploid. Then we have DNA replication. Meiosis 1 begins before birth, okay? And then we have the secondary oocyte, which is haploid. Meiosis 1 is completed only after puberty in a particular egg in a particular month, right? Not all the eggs do this, just there's a cohort. That's the term that's used, or a group of eggs, that's kind of selected. And let's say in this month, in a particular person, maybe 20 eggs begin to undergo the second mitotic division. And so then they stop in the metaphase of the second mitotic division. And then notice here, they show you the extrusion of the second polar body. And they also show you the fact that the first polar body sometimes divides, again, into two polar bodies. But polar bodies are generally thought to be not functional cells. And so the main cell then forms the ovum only after fertilization. So it says on the bottom left, if fertilization occurs after ovulation, meiosis 2 is completed. So are you all with me on this so far? I'd love to have you walk out of here today saying, I get it. I understand the menstrual cycle. So the only way to do that is make sure that we're all on the same page. So anything you want to go over, I'm happy to spend as much time as you like. Yeah. You need the male pronucleus to finish up the second mitotic division. So it's only when that it's truly a haploid cell that's finished up both mitotic divisions, it's really an ovum. That doesn't happen normally unless fertilization occurs, right? Okay. So comparing the two processes then, and I do this because I think it's helpful to learn, and also as we talk about the menstrual cycle, there are some things you can use that you know about the male to help you understand the female and vice versa. So spermatogenesis, you know this already, primary spermatocyte, secondary spermatocyte, spermatid, spermiogenesis, labeled as cell differentiation here, and finally the mature sperm or spermatozoa. In the female, we have the oogonium, primary oocyte, meiosis one, meiosis two, polar body, right? And then we have cell growth, and we have the mature egg cell, or the ovum. So to understand the menstrual cycle, and really to understand physiology, to understand life, you have to have a sense of context, a sense of perspective. And so let's do this now. Let's think about this. So, the oocytes are formed, a child is born, she goes through puberty, and now every month there's going to be a cohort of follicles which contain the oocytes that begin to grow. And so at this point you have primary follicles and primordial follicles. Primordial follicles really are very similar to primary follicles. They just have one layer of cells around them. Primary follicle may have a few layers of cells. The cells become more cuboidal, okay? But the point is, don't get up on the terms so much as trying to understand what's happening. So we have a cohort of follicles that now stirs this particular month and begins to grow. And it does so under the influence of a hormone, which is named correctly here. And that hormone is called follicle stimulating hormone, FSH. Right? So follicle stimulating hormone stimulates the growth of the follicles. And notice now that we have this progression, and this happens in about 2 weeks on average, okay? That you go from this structure, the primary follicle, to this structure, which is the Graafian follicle. So let's say we have 10 follicles, right, in one ovary and 10 in the other. 20 follicles that start growing this month. Okay, they begin to grow, and the cell size here is the same size as here and here and here. So the growth really is not a hypertrophy of the cells, it's a hyperplasia, it's cell division. So lots of cell division going on. And as this progresses, this forms, the primary follicle forms what's called a secondary follicle. It's not shown on this slide, but you'll see in a minute. And eventually it forms the mature or tertiary or Graafian follicle, right? And so all three terms are fine. And so the Graafian follicle is the mature follicle that can rupture and release the egg through a process called ovulation. And so what I'd like to draw your attention here is just how incredible growth process this really is. Because remember, this happens in about 2 weeks. It can happen in a week in some women. Some women have menstrual cycles that are 3 weeks long. Usually this first part is the variable part. And so here we have, what's this, maybe a foot high, right? This one maybe 3 feet high, okay? But it's not drawn correctly because this is about 100 microns. And this is about 5,000 microns. So this should be 50 times bigger than this, okay? You'd appreciate that. So if this was 50 times bigger, it would be, you know, way above the roof of this building, right? It's huge. And so why does it happen? Because of cell division. And at the same time, it's not just dumb old cell division, okay? It's this beautiful process of cells dividing, organizing, secreting, and forming the sphere, the celestial, you know, the spherical, right? The sphere, forming a sphere. And this sphere has kind of, up on a pedestal of cells, has the oocyte. These cells around the oocyte are called the corona radiata, okay? These cells are all granulosa cells, and so are these, and so are these, and so are these, and so are these. So the inner lining of this sphere is composed of granulosa cells, which prop up the egg on a pedestal, okay? And if that egg's released, and those cells remain around it, that's what we call the cumulus oophorus, and the corona radiata being the inner layer of those cells, okay? So just, you know, stay with me with this spherical kind of three-dimensional thing. And so this here is called the antrum. This also is called an antral follicle, but a secondary follicle has an antrum. So that could be a secondary or tertiary follicle. And this antrum is filled with fluid. Where do you think the fluid comes from? Yeah, the granulosa cells, right? And so the granulosa cells secrete this fluid. This builds up a little bit of pressure, and the cells divide, and they grow, and they form the sphere. Now, notice on the outside of the sphere, we have a black line here, which is the basement membrane. That demarcates the edge of the granulosa cells here. And if you go just beyond there, you'll see blood vessels, and you'll also see another cell type. And this is the other cell type, which is called the theca cell, T-H-E-C-A, or T-H-E-C-A-L, a thecal cell, theca cells. And so The theca cells can be of two types. There is an inner layer and an outer layer, and therefore they're called theca interna and theca externa. And so now we have this beautifully organized structure, which you could see with the naked eye. If you do laparoscopy and you inflate the abdomen with air and you look at the ovary, you will see a little bubble on the ovary, quarter of an inch in diameter. That would be the tertiary Graafian follicle. And so fluid-filled and on the surface, and then that follicle will rupture. This part will separate. This will fall out. But all this is still in the ovary, right? I mean, the whole thing doesn't get launched. It's just the oocyte with the granulosa cells around it that is released during ovulation. So we got this shell of the follicle that's left. And so that follicle transforms, and it goes in color, it changes in color from being pinkish to being yellowish, and it changes histologically as well. And so what we call the remaining follicle on the surface of the ovary after ovulation is the yellow body. But of course we use Latin more than we use English, right? So in Latin that's called the corpus luteum. The corpus luteum is yellow. Why do you think it's yellow? Because what? It's composed of fat. That's absolutely right. It's a very fatty little structure, okay? And so why do you want fat on your ovary? Well, the reason is that those hormones, which are so important, that we're going to be talking about for the next half hour, estrogen and progesterone, are fats, right? Steroids are fats. And so the corpus luteum is a steroid factory that releases a lot of estrogen and progesterone. All right, so, but the endocrine part actually begins earlier, because as these follicles grow, remember we said 10 in one ovary, 10 in the other, and they grow, and eventually one pulls out ahead because it grows the fastest, and because it grows the fastest, it's releasing stuff, and now it's releasing something that we've heard about already, a hormone called inhibin, and it's also releasing a hormone called estrogen. So the follicle grows, inhibin estrogen are emanating from it. The one that's furthest ahead will begin to suppress the others as it pulls ahead. And remember, each cell makes estrogen, each cell makes inhibin, and so the more cells, the more estrogen, the more cells, the more inhibin. And so you're going to have the highest levels coming from this one follicle. And those hormones pass into the blood. And, of course, the blood circulates everywhere, and it comes very close to the other follicles that are growing. And that those hormones and some other hormones we don't have time to get into, activin and relaxin and other ones, also participate in modulating and suppressing the growth of the other follicles. So eventually one follicle becomes the winning follicle, if you will, and that's the one that's going to be ovulated. So here's a little bit more detail. This slide, one slide you don't have. It just shows the primordial follicle, primary follicle, secondary follicle. Nice to see that here. And tertiary follicle. You can see, first of all, 40 microns to about 400 microns, and then 5,000 microns as it goes from early to late. You can see that we have the oocyte. You can see that we now have this little layer outside of the oocyte, which is acellular, shown in black here. That's called the zona pellucida. Now, if you talk about a pellucid lake or a pellucid stream, you mean a clear lake. So the zona pellucida is really the clear zone. And so this is the zone that separates the oocyte from these other cells, which are granulosa cells. And now we have the appearance, as the tertiary follicle forms, of the theca cells, externa and interna. These are all granulosa cells, zona pellucida, and the oocyte, which actually grows a little as well. Is that clear? So now if we look at this picture, we can see the story. And so here's the story. We have primary follicles begin to grow. Okay, we have an antrum here. We have secondary follicles. And then finally we get to a tertiary follicle. The mature follicle ruptures. Out comes the ovum, zona pellucida. Normally we'd have a lot of cells clumped around it, those granulosa cells. And then it becomes the corpus luteum. And then if pregnancy doesn't occur after about 2 weeks, and that's a fairly discreet time period. So most women, when they ovulate, they'll begin to menstruate about 2 weeks later. And so that menstruation really is an event that occurs because of the death of the corpus luteum. And so the corpus luteum in the ovary dies, because it's making estrogen and progesterone, the levels of those hormones drop. The estrogen and progesterone support the uterus, support the endometrium. That support is lost. And so now, that endometrium doesn't function normally. It becomes ischemic. It starts clumping. It starts deteriorating. And it starts breaking up. And that's the process of menstruation. So let's go through this again more carefully and put the pieces together. So here we have the follicles, rupture, ovulation, corpus luteum. And then the corpus luteum dies. There's a little pinpoint, a scar, if you will, that's left. That's called the corpus albicans. Alba is white. So just a little white body, okay? It's just a non-functional remnant of that month's corpus luteum. So any questions on that so far? You with me? Yeah, okay. So again, here's a cycle. Now, you know, you should be able to see what's happening here. The primary oocytes growing, secondary oocytes, yeah, got that, okay. Tertiary, here we go. Ovulation, yes. Transformation, corpus luteum, yes. Okay, and then finally, corpus albicans. And so notice that this slide I put in here because it shows you one thing, and that is, you see it says estradiol there. So that follicle, that Graafian follicle, is making a lot of estrogen. And the most common form of estrogen in a non-pregnant state is 17-beta, estradiol, or E2. And so estradiol is being secreted, being released. And then if we look at the corpus luteum, you see it says estradiol, and now we have a new player that's appeared, progesterone. And so progesterone, called P4 often, so E2, P4, one way terming the two, estradiol, progesterone, another way. Progesterone, as the name implies, is pro-pregnancy, right? Because gestation is pregnancy. So progesterone, progestation, it's the thought of as kind of the pregnancy hormone. But in fact, it's very important that we have both estrogen and progesterone throughout pregnancy. So they're really two pregnancy hormones. But they work together, and they do a nice job of keeping things right most of the time. So getting back to this idea of perspective, let's think about this. So, okay, got it. So follicles grow. They make hormones. Those hormones support the endometrium. Follicle pops. Corpus luteum forms. Corpus luteum dies. Endometrium dies. Menstruation. You got that? Yes. Yeah, the question is, what regulates the corpus luteum? So the corpus luteum is on autopilot for 2 weeks. And in fact, it's being regulated partly by the brain. And so this brings us to this slide, which is a perspective slide. So you kind of lead me right into what I was going to ask you. And that is, what is driving this whole thing? Right? Well, what's driving it is the brain. And so it's the same hormones we talked about already. It's GnRH, gonadotropin-releasing hormone coming from the hypothalamus, being secreted into very small blood vessels, which travel only a millimeter or two through a plexus, right, of capillaries, that then ramify through the anterior pituitary. And we have cells called gonadotrophs in the pituitary, and GnRH, gonadotropin-releasing hormone, releases gonadotropins. And so what are the gonadotropins? LH and FSH. FSH we talked about, follicle-stimulating hormone. LH, luteinizing hormone. Ah, you see, luteinizing hormone. So what actually stimulates ovulation and transformation into the corpus luteum? Luteinizing hormone. So they make perfect sense. The terms LH, FSH make perfect sense. But what's really driving it, if you will, is the hypothalamus. And so in the 1960s, when people first isolated GnRH and they isolated the gonadotropins, originally from the urine of Italian nuns, because old people have the highest level of gonadotropins, okay? And so they collect urine from nuns and they extracted and they were able to purify and sequence the structure of the gonadotropins. That's when LH and FSH came to be named as they were. And then GnRH, it was very exciting. And so people said, oh, you know, we can now control the system. We'll infuse GnRH, let's say, into an animal, like a rat. And we should, like, ramp up its reproductive system. And so when, as it often is in science, which is really the fascinating part of science, is you're always surprised somehow in research. You think you know what's going on, and the opposite happens. So here, the opposite happened. And instead of the reproductive organs growing and becoming more active, they actually became involuted. And so people said, well, we must have gotten this wrong. I mean, it must be the wrong, you know, I took the wrong vial, or it's the wrong concentration, or whatever. And they were stuck on this for a while. But then this guy came along, whose name was Ernest Nobile, K-N-O-B-I-L. And Ernest Nobile got the Nobel, N-O-B-E-L prize, a few years later for what he discovered. And what he discovered was that there was a very important pulsatility to the system. And that's, you know, physiology is amazing. It's oscillatory, right? Everything is just changing all the time. So he discovered was that you can't just give the hormone. You've got to give the hormone and then give it again and again and again and again. So you have to have pulses of the hormone being given. And so right around the time of puberty, what actually happens is the hypothalamus gets into this pulsatile rhythm of secreting these hormones. And this begins to then act upon the reproductive organs and upon the ovaries to begin the process of the menstrual cycle. And so cyclic and pulsatile nature of hormone secretion. And what does that mean? It means like if I took a blood sample from you, okay, or from you, and I measured the level of LH and FSH. Then we talked for a little while, and 15 minutes later, we took another blood sample, we measured it again. And then we waited 15 minutes, we measured it again. And we plotted this over a period of several hours. What you'd see is that there's a peak of LH, and then it goes down. There's a peak of LH, and it goes down. About an hour apart, maybe, on average. Okay? So, you know, 20, 30 pulses a day, but pulses. And that's what Nobile discovered and got the Nobel Prize for. And so this is a mechanism for encoding. And so there are two kinds of radios, AM and FM. AM is amplitude modulation. FM is frequency modulation, meaning that if you look at the waves coming out of an AM radio, they're all the same frequency, but they vary in height, amplitude modulation. If you look at the waves coming out of an FM radio, they vary in frequency. There, some are long or some are shorter and so on, okay? So the body uses both, in a sense, amplitude and frequency modulation, because the height of the pulses differs and the time between the pulses differs. And that brain rhythm is what kind of coordinates the menstrual cycle, if you will. And so what happens then? Well, we started talking about the ovary, and we said the first thing that happens is we have to grow a cohort of follicles, right? And so we have those 20 follicles start growing. And so from the standpoint of the ovary, only, not the uterus, the ovary, we can call this first half of the menstrual cycle the follicular phase. Because there's no follicles in the uterus, right? There's no follicles in the brain, only in the ovary. So follicles grow, the follicular phase, and then that one follicle pulls ahead, it ruptures. That's ovulation. That's the ovulatory phase. And then what happens to that shell of that follicle? Remember? Transforms into the corpus luteum, and now we have the second half of the menstrual cycle, the luteal phase, from the standpoint of the ovary. Different things are happening in the uterus. And so how do we, first of all, mark the beginning of a menstrual cycle? Well, you know, you could measure the hormones, I suppose, or you could maybe do ultrasound, but, you know, that's all impractical, right? What's very practical is to say to a person, hey, when did you start menstruating? You know, and most women will know that they began to menstruate, last Thursday, right? So menstruation, beginning of menstruation, is day one of the menstrual cycle. And so menstruation lasts 4 days, 5 days, right? Then it stops, and that's the breaking up of that inner lining of the uterus, the endometrium. And even as it breaks up, the new endometrium begins to grow. And so if we were going to grow corn or anything, we need soil, right? You can't. I mean, you can put corn here and you can water it and it'll sprout, but it's not going to really grow. So we need soil. So that soil, in terms of human reproduction, is the endometrium. And so we get rid of the soil from last month, and now we create a new field in which to grow. And so that really is created and it's measurable in that if you look at the thickness of the endometrium after a woman's completed menstruation, it's maybe 2 millimeters thick. And then if you watch, it'll be 4, and then it'll be 6, it'll be 8, it'll be 9. And then she'll ovulate. And then it still keeps growing, 10, 11, maybe 14, okay? So really from 2 to 14, that's a lot of growth, isn't it? That's in millimeters. And so from the standpoint of the uterus, the first half of the menstrual cycle is characterized by menstruation and by the growth of the endometrium. So we have the menstrual phase, days 1 to 5, the proliferative phase, days 5 to 14, and then, if you look histologically at the endometrium, as it grows, you would see that it increases in thickness, there's more blood vessels, little venules, you know, capillaries. I mean, it's a very rich, kind of, very well-vascularized tissue. But then if you looked at it in the second half of the cycle, all the blood vessels are still there, but you'd say, whoa, man, look at that. Something's different here. And that different thing is that there are a lot of glands in the endometrium. A lot of glands. And those glands secrete stuff. And so, in the uterus, the second half of the cycle is the secretory phase. Are you with me on that? Any questions? Okay, so let's put it together now, time-wise. Here is the drawing or photograph of the endometrium. Here's a drawing of the uterus. We're just taking the same part here. We're looking at it. This is all muscle here. Here's the endometrium right after menstruation. This is the border between the myometrium and the endometrium. Now we have proliferative phase, right? Appropriately termed. We couldn't say follicular phase because it doesn't make any sense. That's in the ovary. But here's the uterus. And so now we have the myometrium down here, transition zone. Then we have the endometrium, which is here. Notice these glands are appearing here. Then by the secretory phase, we have really a very glandular, thick endometrium, you see? And so this process occurs in terms of the endometrial growth. The first, like I said, the first couple days would be menstruation, then it begins to grow, and then transforms to being secretory. So how long does this whole process take? Well, it depends. It depends. Most women have a menstrual cycle that's particular to their body. Or more females have menstrual cycle, particularly to their body. And so some women have a 28-day lunar cycle. And if you do studies, and people have done these studies, and almost every time they do the study, it sort of comes out that more people have a 28-day cycle than a 23-day cycle or a 30-day cycle. So it's kind of a bell-shaped curve. But say somebody had a 21-day cycle and somebody else had a 40-day cycle. And so remember, within this, then, ovulation usually occurs 14 days before the beginning of the next cycle. And so a woman with a 40-day cycle probably ovulated on day 26. A woman with a 21-day cycle probably ovulated on day 7. Incredible difference, isn't it? I mean, that's rare. That's the outliers, okay? But still, we all grow at our own rate, right? We all grow in our own time. And here, it's growth, and so it differs between people. So here is the endocrinology of the menstrual cycle, but it changes, so we can't just have one slide that shows everything right away, because it'd be confusing. But this is worth spending some time on, because it kind of summarizes the first half of the cycle. And so, where do we begin? Well, most logically, we begin with the hypothalamus. So here's GnRH, impulses, anterior pituitary, LH, FSH, impulses. Okay. And, of course, these hormones, because they're hormones, travel throughout the whole body, right? They're in every cell is bathed in these hormones. But the receptors for these hormones are primarily located in the reproductive organs. And so in that ovary, as these follicles are growing, then we have LH acting on the theca cells to make androgens, I think the primary androgen at this point is androstenedione, okay? But just think of it as androgens, you know, testosterone-like molecules. And so the androgens are made by the theca cells. Now picture the follicle, spherical, right? So the blood comes, kind of weaves into capillaries around between the theca cells. There's no blood vessels inside of that basement membrane. There's no blood vessels among the granulosa cells, okay? But the theca cells, yes, they're vascularized. And so LH comes down, binds to those theca cells, makes them make androgens. Well, have you ever seen this before? LH binding to a cell, making androgens? Yeah, like what? Yeah, the Leydig cell, right, in the male. Where are the Leydig cells located relative to the tubule? Inside or outside? Outside. Okay, so here there's a spatial kind of reality we can use to, if you forget something, you kind of can reconstruct it. So remember, Leydig cells, testosterone, if you know that, that's okay. They're on the outside. And so in a female, then, there'd be the theca cells on the outside, and they make testosterone. Yes, true. And so the testosterone from the Leydig cells diffuses into the tubule. The testosterone from the theca cells diffuses into the follicle. And so the follicle has, as its inside layer, granulosa cells, right? And these granulosa cells convert these androgens into estrogens. See, this is why they're so important. And anyone remember how you do this? How do you make an androgen into estrogen? You have to have an enzyme. What's that? Yeah, aromatase. You have to have that aromatase, and they do. And so no problem for them. You know, they get a molecule of testosterone, ding-ding, aromatase, makes it into estrogen. And now that estrogen is released, diffuses out to the theca cells, diffuses out to the blood vessels, circulates throughout the body, right? But what it's really destined for is for the, what? The endometrium, right? Because we've got to get that endometrium growing, right? And so the endometrium grows, yes. Notice the granulosa cells also make inhibin, just like the, what kind of cells in the male? The Sertoli cells, right? So very similar, very similar. I mean, men or males and females, men or women, whatever, different. But in some ways, they're not different, you know. And there's sort of a consistency here that's interesting. It's helpful, I think, for you to think about the processes and remember what happens where. And so we have theca cells, androgens, granulosa cells, inhibin. Notice what acts on the granulosa cells, the inner cells, FSH, just like it acts on Sertoli cells. And so these cells then facilitate oogenesis. They create inhibin. That inhibin has a negative feedback action on the anterior pituitary. The estrogen, in this case, because it's a female, has negative feedback on the anterior pituitary and on the hypothalamus. And so we have negative feedback, estrogen controlling LH, inhibin controlling FSH. Yes? But that's only in the first half of the cycle, okay? Because everything changes when you approach the middle part of the cycle. And this negative system, negative feedback system, becomes a positive feedback system. Very different. So why don't we take a break? And we'll talk about the rest of the story at 2 o'clock, okay?
growing up. The ghetto blaster.
I remember years ago, there was a band called Pinhead in Burlington, Vermont. It was one of the more popular bands in the 80s. The guy who was the lead singer, Doug Knapp, actually still around. He's an artist. He does shows and postcards and things like that. But I discovered this the other day. I didn't realize they had a Pinhead thing on YouTube. You can get anything on YouTube, practically. Amazing. If you want to listen to a fun album, it's a fun album to listen to. Anyway, mostly it's nice to hear some music, isn't it? So let's now pick it up, and let's go from negative to positive feedback. So this is the situation, right? So in the first half of the cycle, and again, if you see the hormones in the menstrual cycle drawn, and you'll see them. I'll show you some pictures. Bless you. If you see them, it's a bunch of bunk, really, okay? Because as you know now, the release of these hormones is cyclic, it's episodic, it varies in amplitude, varies in frequency, and so on. So you can't see, like, the LH level going down or FSH level going down, really. Maybe the pulses are further apart. If you integrate the area under the pulse, you get what I'm saying, okay? But the point is, there is a negative feedback in the first half of the cycle. But then something happens, which is very unusual in physiology. And that is, we go to positive feedback. So before we talk about that, this next slide just reinforces concept of theca cells, LH, androgens, diffusion, FSH, governing granulosa cells, changing them into estrogen. So now let's talk about the positive feedback, okay? Because it's very important, because we've been growing this follicle, right? And now we've got to rupture that follicle. So how do we do that? And so, of course, the clue is luteinizing hormone, LH. And so What happens then is that as you have that cohort growing, and they're all making estrogen, right? But the big one pulls ahead, the dominant follicle pulls ahead, makes the most estrogen. And so if you look at the levels of estrogen in the bloodstream of a female in the first half of the cycle, you see that those levels are kind of creeping up, 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 up. Yeah.
Why doesn't that estrogen also inhibit the follicle?
Because the follicle knows. Okay. It's making the most, and it's suppressing the others, and that's the way nature designed it, okay? There's no autocrine effect, all right? And so, but it does begin to inhibit, I mean, it's a good point, anyway, because it does begin to inhibit the brain, and so maybe the other follicles are getting less stimulation from the brain, but this one's going crazy. It's like, yeah, you know, it's going to be the dominant follicle, yay, you know, I'm going to ovulate. And so, so it makes estrogen, estrogen, estrogen. And so here we have estrogen. Now you see positive, positive. I mean, so all of a sudden it starts ramping this up, okay? And particularly not FSH, notice LH. FSH also goes up, not nearly as much. And now that LH, by perhaps, it's not very well understood, but perhaps by increasing the secretion of the fluid by the granulosa cells, building up a little pressure inside of that follicle, by maybe making the connections between the cells a little weaker, okay, it's able to pop that follicle. And so that's ovulation. And so if we looked at the levels of the hormones during the menstrual cycle, what you would see is this progressive rise in estrogen during the first half of the cycle. Then it kind of goes down. It's still around a fair amount of it in the second half of the cycle. The red line, which we'll get to in a minute, is progesterone. Notice it's quite low, and then it goes up in the second half of the cycle. So the first half of the cycle is dominated by estrogen. The second half is dominated by progesterone. Where are they coming from? Estrogen is coming from the growing follicles and eventually from the dominant follicle. Progesterone is coming from the corpus luteum, which is what the dominant follicle was before it popped. And so, but notice here now we also have this little green line, which goes up, shoots up, and it comes right down. And so that is the LH. And so when we talk about something that is big, you know, we could say increase in LH, elevation in LH, okay? It doesn't quite connote the dramatic quality of it. And so the word that people use regarding this event is LH surge. As you know, a storm surge on the sea, big waves, a lot of water, right? Troop surge. We've had several troop surges in Iraq, right, in Afghanistan. So it connotes a big thing. And so here we have an LH surge. And I made this slide together. I drew this slide to try to illustrate kind of the sequence of events, what happens. So the way to look at it is that estrogen is being made by all the follicles, eventually by the dominant follicle the most, okay? And so as it's being made and it increases, there's negative feedback on LH. And so there's this negative feedback zone, if you will. And then roughly, in humans, it's around 300 picograms per mil, roughly about that point, okay? Once the estrogen gets higher, everything flips the other way. So now we have the positive feedback zone. You see the green versus the red. So as soon as estrogen's up here, that LH starts increasing. And so there's a progressive increase in estrogen. LH is kind of going down. Pulses maybe are further apart, maybe a little smaller. And all of a sudden, that LH starts going up, and it surges, it crests, and it goes down. And it's not like a minute or an hour or 10 hours. It's maybe, I don't know, 36 hours or something that this happens. And so we have the dominant follicle, which is doing several things. It's priming the action of GnRH on LH secretion to stimulate the surge. It's preparing the endometrium for progesterone, okay, because that's the other hormone. Remember, that's going to be coming into play to evoke those glands to secrete. It will stimulate the fallopian tube to favor transport of the ovum down the fallopian tube. It'll alter the cervical mucus to help the sperm get through. We'll talk about that. And it and an inhibin together will inhibit the growth of that cohort of follicles. So you see, the dominant follicle is a busy little thing. I mean, it's doing a lot of stuff. And so here's the LH surge. And so you can see it's not, like I say, it's not short. This is 48 hours. And so estrogen's going up, 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 and all of a sudden this starts going up, and it wobbles itself way high, Ovulation happens, and then it goes down. So that's the LH surge, which leads to ovulation. That makes sense? Through a positive feedback mechanism. And you just have to accept it. It's like a slot machine. You know, you put in quarter, and you get back, hopefully, you get back, you know, 100 quarters. Well, same thing here. The estrogen stimulates a positive effect, which leads to the surge. Again, the mechanism of ovulation, high levels of estrogens from almost mature vesicular, ovarian, graafian follicles stimulate the release of GnRH. The GnRH stimulates LH. The LH surge promotes ovulation. Now we have, notice they were accurate in their terminology here, the ovulated secondary oocyte with this clump of cells around it. Somebody asked me about corona radiata versus cumulus oophorus. You know, the terms are often used interchangeably. The cumulus oophorus, oophorus, refers to the clump of cells that's around the oocyte. The corona radiata sometimes is referred to the innermost lining of cells or to the thinner crown-like lining of cells on top of the oocyte. It's just a terminology thing. It really isn't that important. But the point is that the oocyte now tumbles out of that follicle, and that follicle transforms to be the corpus luteum. So here's a picture of ovulation with a taken with a camera. You can see this clump of fluid, and also probably the follicle right here being released from the surface of the ovary. And so here's a drawing that my poor daughter drew when she was young years ago. But she drew well, so I said, come on, honey, you can make a drawing here. And so she drew, dorky dad, she drew the corpus luteum forming. So basically, here we have the surface of the ovary, and then we have the oocyte here, the clump of cells, it's granulosa cells in here, the antrum, the basal membrane, and notice here it shows the blood vessels nicely, okay, and here's the theca cells, interna externa cells, and then ovulation happens, and these cells, of course, are still here, here's the surface of the ovary, here are all these cells, and then these cells transform into the yellow body of the corpus luteum. And so histologically, the corpus luteum is composed of large and small cells. Sometimes they're called granulosa lutein and theca lutein, small cells, large cells. But it's fairly indistinct and variable. The point is, this very kind of organized structure then collapses. Now we have a bunch of cells, large and small, which are producing a lot of hormones. And so here's a photograph of a corpus luteum from a monkey. You can see it is yellow, in fact. And this is one that's been ovulated. And here's all the cells that are making the progesterone estrogen. Probably maybe the egg was attached here. Now that egg is gone. And so let's talk a little bit about the endometrium because it's so important, right? And so the endometrium, histologically, we haven't really seen a good picture of it yet. We saw a slide just of a stain of the endometrium. But here you can see what's in it. And you can see here, this is the main uterine artery. These are the arcuates, the radials, the spirals. And so we're talking about this innermost layer, the endometrium. And here is the inner lining, inner part of it. Here's the outer part joining the myometrium. We've got the arteries, the spiral arteries. We've got the venules. And we've got these glands, you see, that empty out into the lumen of the uterus. And so they make a compound called uterine milk. Probably helps also antibiotic to some degree, helps right pH, just makes a nice environment for the fertilized egg to tumble down into. Because once an egg is fertilized, it takes about a week for it to get down to the uterus. So there's plenty of time. Somebody also asked me about why is the corpus luteum, why doesn't it die if pregnancy occurs? And so that's a very wise question, because if the corpus luteum died, estrogen and progesterone levels would drop, and you begin to menstruate. And so you're not going to be able to sustain a pregnancy if you menstruate. So it's very important that we prevent any more menstruations. And in fact, it's prevented by this clump of cells. The fertilized egg divides into a clump of cells. This clump of cells begins to secrete a hormone, which is like LH, which keeps the corpus luteum going. And that hormone is the hormone we use to detect pregnancy. It's called HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin, early pregnancy hormone. And that keeps the corpus luteum going. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about pregnancy. So if you look at this now, you ought to be able to kind of tell me what day of the cycle or period, what phase of the cycle this is. So here we have the mature follicle with eggs. So let's say, would they, on a 28-day cycle, we think, what day might this be? Yeah, 12, 13, maybe 14, right? Middle part of the cycle. And once ovulation happens, the temperature of the body goes up because progesterone levels increase, has a metabolic effect. And so if you can, and let me tell you the important fact, and then we'll step back and talk about this. The important fact is this, that once the egg is released, it's only capable of being fertilized for about 16 to 20 hours. That's it. So one day after ovulation, you can't get pregnant. The egg's broken up. It's not there. So for a couple who's trying to have kids, it's really nice to know when you'll be ovulating, right? And so there are several ways to detect ovulation. One of the older ways is this, which is a woman lies in bed and she measures her body temperature. And before she gets up, before she walks around, okay, and that body temperature increases after she ovulates. Another way is some women can feel ovulation. They feel a little pain, all right? So that's another way. But who wants to lay in bed and measure your temperature, and then you got to hurry because it's happened already, right? So you have your tick-tock, you know, you have 16 hours. So you have to call your partner and say, hey, come home for lunch, and, you know, why don't you plan a long lunch, and let's see what we can do, you know? So it'd be better to know ahead of time. So this is an even worse way. Okay, this is called the Spinbarkite. And the Spinbarkite is, you can get up, instead of measuring your temperature, you can have a couple of glass slides and some swabs next to your bed. And you can reach in and take a little cervical mucus and spread it on the slides and put the slides together and pull them apart and see how far you can pull them apart before that strand breaks. Okay? And then you can have the slide dry and look at the ferning pattern it forms on the slide and decide if you ovulate. Well, who wants to do that, right? I mean that's really, it doesn't sound like fun at all. So, and again, it's kind of late, okay? It's kind of late. So the age we live in, we have things like this, which is the Clear Blue, just one company, digital ovulation test. And all you need to do is you need to put a little urine on the sensor, and then if your urine contains a high level of LH, it'll detect that, and you'll have a little, I love this, you have a little smiley face up here, okay? And some of these, I don't know if they have like a grin versus a smile, but they have a way of telling you that you're going to be ovulating in 12 hours or in 24 hours or in 36 hours, about. So you know. So then you can say, look, honey, come home tonight and have a glass of wine and let's plan on just being together tonight and see what happens, okay? Because the chances now of something happening are the highest they'll be the whole month, right? And a day later or 2 days later, it's all over till the next cycle. You know? And so, I mean, sex is wonderful and, you know, I mean, our society has a strange paradoxical approach to it, I think. But anyway, sexual love, you know, making love, all that stuff is fine. When you have to make love, it loses some of its veneer, you know what I mean? Like, we've been making love for 18 months now, wanting to have a child, and we don't have a child yet, you know? So it really becomes like different, you know? Not spontaneous. I mean, so anyway, so this is a beautiful thing. For $30, $40, you get a digital ovulation test. You can predict when you can ovulate ahead of time and plan accordingly. Yeah.
So I imagine someone
feels,
or feel that the ovulation doesn't happen until like 6 months.
Sure. No, it's just a one-time measure, and because the urine sort of averages it, you know, and then urine could be really dilute or it could be concentrated, you know, it's but basically the levels are so high compared to the rest of the cycle that it can detect it, okay? Any other questions? Okay. So let's put it all together, folks. Hopefully you understand us now. So this kind of, you know, puts together all the stuff we're talking about in one big slide. So, it starts off by talking about the pulse frequency, remember that, right, GnRH, and notice that it starts off about 15 per day, goes up to maybe 40, and then drops down, and so there's an encoding here, an encoding process. Okay, this is the frequency encoding. And so gonadotropic hormone levels, FSH and LH, notice no one knows how to draw this part, so they just draw a straight line or maybe coming down or whatever, But then the key thing is this, boom, LH surge, also peak in FSH, and then they drop back down, okay? Follicular stages during the ovarian cycle, follicle development, ovulation, corpus luteum formation, mature corpus luteum here making hormones, and finally death of the corpus luteum, corpus albicans. And incidentally, the corpus luteum dies during the Farias system. In humans, it's less clear, but in most mammals, what happens is the uterus makes prostaglandins. And those prostaglandins, leaving the uterus and the uterine blood, flow out in the blood. And then the arteries that go to the veins are usually very close. I'm sorry, the arteries that go to the corpus luteum are very close to the uterine veins. And so these prostaglandins are transferred from the vein to the artery. They flow up into the corpus luteum. And they're very potent vasoconstrictors. And so they constrict the blood vessels that are feeding the corpus luteum. And the corpus luteum dies this awful strangulation death that's caused by the uterus. Isn't it nefarious? Right? And that's what happens. And so if you rob an organ of a blood supply, that organ is going to die. And so that's what happens. Corpus luteum dies, becomes the corpus albicans. And so here we have the ovarian hormone levels, basically estrogen levels kind of coming up and then dropping down, but still fairly high. Progesterone levels low, but then go up kind of high and then come back down. And so when the corpus luteum dies, these hormones crash. And so the endometrium, then also menstruation, then we have the phase, proliferative phase, then we have the secretory phase, okay? And finally, just incidental, I guess, body temperature also goes up. Now, to be honest with you, and I don't mean to confuse, I hesitate to say this sometimes because it's maybe confusing a little bit, but it's true. And that is that, you know, actually, first of all, the concentrations of estrogen are much lower in the blood than progesterone. And even in the first half of the cycle, there is some progesterone. There's actually more progesterone than estrogen in the first half of the cycle. If you take a blood level from a woman in the first half of the cycle, measure progesterone, estrogen, estrogen is going to be picogram per mil, and progesterone is going to be nanogram per mil. Okay? But it's the relative amounts that matter. And so the relative amounts of estrogen increase a lot in the first half of the cycle, and then they drop back down. The relative amounts of progesterone are fairly constant in the first half of the cycle, and then they really increase in the second half of the cycle. And parenthetically, these two hormones are good friends in a sense. They help each other out. And so estrogen may induce progesterone receptors to form, for example, on those glands. And then the progesterone comes along and has receptors to bind to, makes its effect. So there's a cooperativity at the sex steroid level that goes on. So any questions on that? Okay, hopefully you're with me on this. And so same slide you saw already, just reinforces the endometrial changes. And now let's see, look at this. What day of the cycle might this be? Well, the egg is being released, so probably ovulation, probably day 14 of a 28-day cycle, right? Notice also here, they show a clear mucus being secreted from the cervix. And this one, this slide here, you can't see what kind of corpus it is, but you could probably guess. Thick endometrium, corpus luteum. What day might this be, do you think? Yeah, you know, it could be day, I don't know, it could be day 17 or day 20 or day 24, whatever. Right? It's not day 28 and it's not day 14, but somewhere in there, the second half of the cycle, the luteal phase, which is sometimes it's called, you have a thick mucus and you have the corpus luteum. And so because the egg dies within a day, that's okay, because now the thick mucus will cap, if you will, off the cervix. And by doing that, the body has a chance to get the inside of the uterus ready for implantation. So if there's any bacteria, they'll be taken care of. And in some animals, this is actually forms a waxy plug called a cervical plug. In humans, it's not that discreet. But the mucus does become thick. Where it translates into a practical thing, though, is that most kids, who particularly a teenager, might have acne. And so she might have acne that gets worse in the second half of her menstrual cycle. And so the reason it gets worse is because progesterone is there. This is important for the reproductive system, but we also have sebaceous glands all over their bodies, right? They secrete oil. And so if we have a thickening of that secretion, that gland is more likely to get clogged. And so if that gland gets clogged, you have a little infection, you got a pimple. And so for young girls who have acne, by going on a birth control pill that is low in progesterone and higher in estrogen, like ortho-tricycline is one, there's a couple of them that are particularly good in that regard, you can really make an incredible change in the appearance of the skin, which is, of course, very important at that age because it's a very sensitive age. And so from a reproductive standpoint, we have the clear, thin mucus in the first half of the cycle. And once, if pregnancy happened, it would have happened at that point. Ovulation happened and fertilization happened, it would have happened. And so then we have a thick mucus that kind of caps off the lower end of the cervix. And finally here, we have the corpus albicans, and we have the breaking up of the endometrium, menstruation. And so this would be the beginning of the next cycle, day one, day two, day three, day four, of the next cycle, so menstruation. Is that clear? You think, guys, you have it, you think? I mean, you know, it's a lot of stuff, but it kind of works together and like clock, you know? It's just this gear turns that gear. I mean, it's nice. Brain, hypothalamus, GnRH, LH, FSH, negative feedback, flipping to positive feedback, LH surge, ovulation, progesterone coming on board, corpus luteum, dying, next cycle starting. Okay, well, think about that. And like I said, I have notes. If you read the notes, maybe we'll reinforce. So let's finish up the non-pregnant female here with a couple slides talking about some of the actions of estrogen and progesterone. And so there are stick models of these hormones. And, you know, honestly, if you look at it real quick, you probably couldn't see any difference between them. But there's a big difference in their biological actions. And so estrogen has 18 carbons. Progesterone has 21 carbons. And so eight important actions of estrogen are a stimulation of the growth of the ovaries and the follicles at puberty, maintenance of smooth muscle and epithelium, a growth of the external genitalia at puberty, a growth of the breasts, particularly the ducts of the breasts at puberty, development of a female appearance, stimulation of watery sebaceous gland secretions, retention of fluid, and a closure of the epiphyses of the bone. So those are all very important actions of estrogen, and hopefully you kind of know half of them already anyway. Estrogen is a fascinating hormone, and so there, in terms of how it acts at the nuclear level, and for years it was thought that it only acted at the nuclear level, but in fact it actually acts at the membrane level as well through different receptors. But the classic pathway involves estrogen receptor alpha, estrogen receptor beta, two types of receptors that are present in most cells in different amounts, different portions. Estrogen binds to these receptors. The complex migrates to sit on top of some genes, promoter elements, turning on gene activation, production of things, running the cell, basically. Now, when a woman goes through menopause, she loses her estrogen levels. And that's bad because when you lose estrogen, women have a low-level heart disease up until maybe the sixth or seventh decade. And by the eighth decade, they actually surpass men in heart disease, you know, because of loss of estrogen. So estrogen is a cardioprotective hormone. And so drug companies are always trying to find ways to make estrogen-like molecules that people can take that will do the good stuff but not the bad stuff. And so in this case, this is a drawing, a drawing of a receptor for estrogen. And it shows you estrogen in purple nestled in this receptor on the left side. And raloxifene, which is one of the so-called SERMs, which stands for Selective Estrogen Receptor Modulator, it's a fake estrogen that's nestled in that same receptor. And so different SERMs may activate alpha versus beta receptors. Some have really bizarre actions, like tamoxifen is a drug that's used in breast cancer. It has anti-estrogen actions, but also has pro-estrogen actions. So it's very complicated. And people are really trying to figure this out, and probably will be for years to come. But a very powerful hormone. Now, progesterone also gets less attention, but it's also very important. It stimulates the secretions by the endometrial glands, check, you know that, right? Induction of thick, sticky cervical secretions, check, you know that. Stimulation of myometrial growth during pregnancy, makes sense. Progesterone, something's going to make that uterus grow. Decreased motility of uterine smooth muscle. So I think of it as exciting estrogen and peaceful progesterone. Because once you're pregnant, you don't want a lot of crazy stuff going on. You just want a nice growth, you know, not too many contractions. So peaceful progesterone, decrease in motility of uterine smooth muscle. Okay, stimulation of the breast growth, the puberty, primarily glandular tissue, but also in, during pregnancy. It inhibits prolactin because prolactin is made, but if you start making milk before you have a child, that's not very efficient. And so there has to be a way of sort of putting the brakes on, and that way is through progesterone. And finally, like estrogen, it also has feedback effects on the hypothalamus and on the pituitary. So any questions on that? Well, let's finish up this section then. What time is it? 2:30. Good. We're right on time. Let's talk about some common female reproductive disorders in a non-pregnant state. So the first one is premenstrual syndrome, PMS. You all know what it is. You all heard of it. It can vary in severity quite a bit. And so some people have feel really horrible, and some people just feel a little worse, you know, maybe even don't feel worse, but a whole range of symptoms in different people. But this is in the phase before menstruation begins, usually the week or 10 days before menstruation begins. When a woman feels bloated, she may feel crampy, and she doesn't, you know, it's not a good feeling. It's due to the hormones. And so one of the things a woman can do is go on a birth control pill. This can sometimes alleviate the symptoms, or at least, I guess alleviate is the right word, or make, improve the symptoms of pre-PMS because the hormone levels are lower in pills than they are normally in the body in most cases. Amenorrhea, when you have an A in front of a medical word, usually it means not, right? So this is not, not menstruating, amenorrhea. If you miss your period 3 months in a row, that's clinically significant. Person should probably see somebody. Could be a lot of reasons, some benign, some not so benign. It depends. Endometriosis, kind of a strange disease. It's due to clumps of menstrual tissue, which instead of passing out of the vagina, go up into the fallopian tube, fall out of the end of the fallopian tube, lodge on the body wall or on the gut, and then they stay there and they grow and they wax and wane each menstrual cycle, and they can cause bleeding, cause pain, okay? Endometriosis. Now, it used to be thought that the reason for it was that some women have retrograde menstruation. But in fact, everyone has retrograde menstruation. There's always some clumps of menstrual flow that actually go back the other way and go into the body cavity. But for some reason, in some women, this tissue is more aggressive. And so it seeds, it grows, and it causes problems. PID, pelvic inflammatory disease, as the name implies, just refers to inflammation of the pelvic organs. There are benign tumors like gliomyoma. About 4 uteri a week are taken out at the UVM Medical Center here because of gliomyomas. These are benign tumors of smooth muscle in the myometrium. They could be as large as a softball. There could be many of them. The more common name is uterine fibroids. And so if they're severe, they can cause cramp, bleeding. It'd be a real problem. Sometimes if they occur close to menopause, if the woman can get to menopause, then she can she'll lose the symptoms of the fibroids, and there'll be some shrinkage of the fibroids because the female hormones drop, right, after menopause, and they're the ones that kind of sustain the tumor. And finally, the things we all fear, cancerous tumors, breasts, endometrial cancer, ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancer, particularly nasty. I lost a very close friend a few years ago to ovarian cancer, and she didn't feel anything really, just kind of felt a little bloated, didn't feel quite right. Tired, kind of stressed out, you know. And so by the time she went in, as often happens with ovarian cancer, it was too late. The reason is that the ovarian cancer is not a primarily metastatic through the bloodstream cancer. It's a sloughing cancer. And so cancer cells form and they slough off the ovary and they seed in the abdomen. So a person may have 100 tumors growing, not even know it. And as the tumors become larger and become more symptomatic, at that point it's too late. So very serious, very sad cancer, ovarian cancer. Any questions, folks? Breast cancer, of course, I think you all heard and know about. So this is not a course in pathology, but I think it's good to kind of step back and say, okay, what can go wrong? These are the most common things that can go wrong. Yeah. You know, I don't believe so. I'm not an expert by any means on ovarian cancer, so I don't know. But I don't think so. Does anyone know? Right. This is a cancer marker, general cancer marker, yeah.
Yeah, they're looking at a lot of
problem with a lot of markers is you have false positives, you know, and then it's just variable between different people. You know, it's like the prostate PSA is just about useless, you know, as people learn more about it, because it's just not that helpful. So. Yep. Yes, no, right, that's more for endometrial. So. Okay, folks, part three. I think I had part two on your slides. Part three, reproductive physiology of the pregnant female. So this is the... What's the matter? What's the matter? Huh? No? Okay. This is when we talked about ovulation, okay? This is the structure that might be ovulated. You guys have to change your trans... Yeah, okay, sorry. Is it posted? I hope it is. Yeah. Ellen's very good. I know. Are you with me? All together now. Yes. All right. So let's now pass. And I think I love the whole section, teaching this whole section, but I love from here to the end. I just love the most, because it's just fascinating. It's really life, you know, study of life. And so if a woman ovulates, what does she really ovulate? Well, she ovulates the egg, right? The secondary oocyte. There's a polar body tucked in underneath the zona pellucida. And the zona pellucida I mentioned briefly, but the zona pellucida is an acellular glycoprotein egg shell, if you will. Okay, but here it's not an egg shell yet. It's soft. And it separates the oocyte from the granulosa cells. And so for a sperm to penetrate the egg, it would have to go through some of these cells. You see the corona radiata. Corona radiata, it has to go through the zona pellucida in particular, and finally you have to get to the surface of the egg. So how does this happen? So here's the probability of getting pregnant relative to the day of ovulation. Notice, as I told you earlier, one day after ovulation, the chance of getting pregnant are zero. Now, having said that, you know, there's always exceptions. I'm sure somebody got pregnant 2 days after ovulating somewhere in the world at some time, okay? But statistically, the chances are very, very low, one day after ovulation. Their highest day of ovulation, they're still high a day or two before ovulation, because sperm can live in the female reproductive tract for several days. And by about 6 days out, there's very little chance, if you have intercourse 6 days before you ovulate, there's very little chance that you'll actually become pregnant. So this is a, you know, thinking about this fertility phase, if you will, from 9 to 15 days, roughly, days 9 to day 15 of a 28-day cycle. This is from some birth control pills. And it just shows, it's a nice drawing that shows you bleeding cycle starts, and then day 9 to day 15, that's the fertility phase, which hopefully you won't have because you're taking these pills. But if you weren't taking them, that's where you'd be most fertile, and then the rest of the cycle. And so where does fertilization occur? Usually about in the upper third of the oviduct. And so the sperm have to swim up through the cervix, through the uterus, up into the fallopian tube, and eventually be fertilized probably two-thirds of the way up in the fallopian tube. Well, who would be the lucky one? Is there a process of selection for the sperm? I mean, imagine a man ejaculates a billion sperm, right? And so that person then had a billion cells, okay, and one of those cells maybe will be the lucky one. And so is it a remarkably fabulous sperm cell from that male that gets there? Well, probably not, because no, it's true, because roughly half and maybe even two-thirds of pregnancies terminate spontaneously. And so a woman may not even know she's pregnant. She may have a little spotty bleeding. But these are so-called chemical losses. And so let's just say 5 out of 10 fertilized eggs get destroyed by the body. Why? Because the genome, you know, the genetic information isn't right in the male or in the female, in the egg or in the sperm, right? So if 50% fail, it can't be that there's one super sperm that's going to really make it. I mean, it's very unlikely, okay? But there are some attractants that the egg produces that may attract sperm. And so the oocyte enters the fallopian tube within 15 minutes of ovulation. Those fimbriae, the kind of splayed end of the oviduct, find the oocyte granulosa complex, sweep it into the oviduct, Tubal residence is not required for fertilization. If you can get the egg, collect the egg and the corona radiata, you can fertilize it in a dish. It happens every day. And the oocyte fertilizable lifespan, and I was generous here, is 24 hours max. Most books will tell you 16 to 20 hours, but let's say 24 hours. At the same time, the sperm ascend through the cervical mucus. Remember that reverse peristalsis helps propel them because it's the gel for the first 20, 30 minutes, the semen is. And so sperm are found in a tube of peritoneal cavity within 5 minutes of intercourse. So there's no way they could swim that fast. So clearly there are other mechanisms that facilitate the passage of sperm up into the female reproductive tract. Non-capacitated sperm may be stored in cervical crypts. Some of these are very well developed in some species, and humans are not terribly well developed, but they're just kind of areas where the sperm can hide, if you will, if you want to be anthropomorphic about sperm. And they don't get capacitated because, remember, capacitation is that process of acquiring the ability to fertilize an egg because the sperm are decapacitated. Remember we said that when they pass through the epididymis, there are these lipids that get put onto the head of the sperm. And so this stabilizes the sperm membrane. They're decapacitated. And as they pass up into the female reproductive system, the fluids in the system wash off these things and they become capacitated. And so there's an incredible attrition of sperm in a female reproductive tract. So look at this slide. There's 250 million sperm were ejaculated by this male. And now, 2 minutes later, it's maybe 99% of the sperm are dead. Okay? It's only 1% still alive. And so of that 1%, of that 1%, the ones that become capacitated, gone. Okay. I love digital stuff, man. I tell you. Did anyone ever lose like 6 hours of their email? Bear with me. It's happened a couple times. Like you look back. Yesterday, I sent some stuff to myself because that's then I come to work and get it. And it's like from 4 o'clock to 8 o'clock Sunday, I sent 3 emails and not there anymore. I know where they are. You know? Had to drive home today to get that same file. Anyway, here we go. So sperm capacitation is defined as the acquisition of the ability to undergo the acrosome reaction, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, the ability to bind to the zona pellucida, and also hypermotility. They really start swimming quickly, okay? But they also are going to die quickly. So this is the last phase of the happy sperm life, in which they become hypermotile, look for the egg, and if they don't find the egg in a couple hours, they die. So it's really capacitation is a removal of these decapacitation factors. So I made this very complex graphic for you, okay? So sperm swimming, and they come off, okay? And then that's capacitated. Now it's swimming quickly and looking for the egg. And so with sperm capacitation, the sperm membrane becomes less stable. The sperm loses some of the epididymally derived decapacitation factors. It becomes responsive to chemotactic factors from the egg, and it develops a finite and a shortened lifespan. And so hopefully it'll live long enough to achieve fertilization. And fertilization is a process that allows for procreation with a single act of coitus. It allows gamete interaction in a tubal vastness, because even though the tube is only 4 or 5 inches long, I mean, compared to the size of a sperm and the egg, it's a lot of space in there. It blocks interspecies fertilization. There's a block to interspecies fertilization we'll talk about, and or multiple fertilization. And it allows for genetic recombination to create a new individual. So now we have the 23 chromosomes from the male, 23 chromosomes from the female coming together to form a 46-chromosome cell, the ovum, the fertilized egg. And so let's spend the next, 2:41? So next 9, 10 minutes. I'd love to get through this next section. That's a good place to stop. So this is a drawing of what happens around the time of fertilization. It's an amazing kind of stuff. A lot of stuff happens. It's amazing how coordinated and how well it happens. And so this shows you the first thing that happens. And that is that the sperm, and this just shows you an egg with some sperm. Okay, this is a close-up. Here's the egg surface, the oolemma. Here's the zona pellucida. Here are the granulosa cells. And so as the sperm approaches the egg, notice that its head begins to kind of dissolve, and these enzymes are released and exposed. And now it's able to penetrate through the zona pellucida And it kind of comes to land on his ear, if you will, on the surface of the egg, because that's where the receptors are for binding. And then it's internalized. So that's the acrosome reaction. You have to know three reactions, okay? That's the acrosome reaction. And the zona pellucida, which is that zone we just talked about, this here, as I said, it's acellular. It's composed of three proteins. Please don't memorize the molecular weights. Who cares? But the fact that it's important is it's composed of it's a glycoprotein matrix. So it has both carbohydrates and proteins. And there's three proteins nicely named for all of us, the ZP1, the ZP2, the ZP3. Okay, zona pellucida 1, 2, and 3. And so what happens then is the acrosome reaction is a fragmentation of the acrosomal cap, an exposure of these enzymes, which allow it to pass through the zona pellucida. So this slide will take us from the first reaction to the second reaction, which is called the cortical reaction. So the zona reaction, the acrosome reaction, kind of shown here, you see the red? That's the acrosome. Sperm comes in. Eventually, it's taken into the egg. Notice now, actually, on this slide as well, you see these little vesicles that are floating around just beneath the surface? These are so-called cortical vesicles. And so they're shown magnified here. See them here? So just beneath the surface of the olemma, the membrane of the egg, are floating these spheres, these little vesicles. And so as soon as the sperm penetrates the egg, it triggers all sorts of second messenger stuff, calcium waves, you know, depolarization, enzyme activation, and this sweeps through the cytoplasm of this big cell and triggers these guys to move to and fuse with the membrane of the egg. And when they do that, they exocytose, they release their contents into the zona pellucida. And so that is the cortical reaction. So we have the acrosome reaction, and then we have the cortical reaction. And so the cortical reaction is important because it leads to the zona reaction. And this is the height of tragedy for sperm, okay? So imagine this. You've had a billion friends, okay? You know, 990 million of them are dead, all right? Or 999 million of them are dead, okay? And you're down to just a couple thousand, and you're near the end, and you're swimming, and you're hyper, you know, you've gone to capacity, you know, you're capacitated, and so you're really wiggling, you're swimming, you know, you want to, where's the egg? And you see the egg, okay? And so, who wants to be an egg? Will you be an egg for me? Would you be an egg? You don't want to be, that's okay, I understand. Who wants to be an egg? I'm not evolved enough for that, okay? You're fine, you can be an egg. What's your name?
Ryan.
Okay, Ryan's an egg. So I'm approaching Ryan. I'm so happy because I see Ryan, right? And Ryan's beautiful. He's right here. And here I come, okay? Here I come and I see Ryan and all of a sudden I feel this awful pressure on my head, okay? And I'm like, what's going on? Oh, what's going on? And I get trapped. And I'm looking at Ryan right here. And that's it. I'm going to die looking at Ryan, okay?
Oh.
It's terrible. It's horrible. It's horrible. And so the reason for that is that one of my friends beat me to the egg, okay? And they got into the egg first. And once they're inside the egg, they trigger the cortical reaction, right? And see how it spreads now, this yellow thing? Well, the cortical reaction triggers a polymerization and a cross-linking of those zona proteins. And so that nice, soft, you know, goopy little eggshell all of a sudden hardens. And any sperm, and there could be a dozen of them even, right, in that eggshell are now trapped. They can't fertilize the egg. And so that's the third reaction. So we have the acrosome reaction, then we have fertilization leading to the cortical reaction, then we have the cortical reaction leading to the zona reaction. You with me? So here are the zona pellucidar proteins in their polymerized cross-linked state. You see ZP2, ZP3 form these long polymers, and they're cross-linked by ZP1. So, very effective way to block fertilization by more than one sperm, which is very important. Because if you have two sperm fertilize an egg, that's not going to be a viable pregnancy. And so these proteins are very important in that they block polyspermy. There's also carbohydrates, though, you see. And so the carbohydrates are very important because the carbohydrates are the species block, if you will. And so here we have the sea lion and the dolphin, okay, and they love each other. And they want to have babies, okay? And they figure out how to do it even, all right? But they can't have babies because they're different species, you see? And so the reason is that the carbohydrates in the zona pellucida. That's what messes everything up. If you get rid of those carbohydrates, you can half-fertilize an egg. And in fact, there's a test that was used clinically. It's not used much anymore. It's called the hamster zona-free egg penetration test. Kind of a mouthful, right? Hamsters, zona-free. Okay, they take the eggs from hamsters. They chemically get rid of the zona. Hamster zona-free egg penetration test. Take human sperm, put it on a hamster egg. Will it penetrate or not? Okay? And so, for example, why might it not? What might be the problem? Let's see how good scientists you are. What's that? Size of what? No, sperm is fine. I mean, the hamster egg is big and the sperm is about the same size, okay? So it's not size, but it can't fertilize that egg. Why do you think could be a problem, you think? Enzymes in the acrosome, yes, but we've taken care of that because we've taken away the corona radiata. We've taken away the zona, right? You have an idea? Exactly. You need receptors to bind that ear. You know, I said the ear kind of lands on its ear. Well, there are receptors that bind the egg and the sperm together. So if the sperm don't have those receptors, they'll never be able to penetrate the egg. So that was a test that was developed. But the point is, without the zona, a human sperm can penetrate a hamster egg. It may even divide a few times, but then it's going to just die off. And so in the very first, I'll finish up on this slide, in the very first day or so, then what happens is you have the binding of the sperm and the egg, you have these calcium waves being released, okay, the sperm tail movement stops. Notice cortical granule exocytosis, the cortical reaction, right? 5 minutes, and then 10 minutes, the anaphase movement of egg chromosomes begins. Remember, folks, that egg's got to finish up its mitotic division, right? So it's stuck in metaphase, hip-met, right? Metaphase, now it's going to go through anaphase, telophase, and be done. And it'll extrude a second polar body. And then the sperm nucleus decondenses. The egg and the sperm nuclei form. A period of DNA synthesis starts, and we have the first cleavage. If I show you one more slide, and we'll finish on this, because there's just a nice pictorial of this. This is an egg fertilized by a sperm. One of these is the male, one of these is the female pronucleus. And now they begin to drift together, intercalate, form one nucleus, and then we have 46 chromosomes, and then that cell begins to divide. Okay? A new life has started. Of course, old life never ended, right? The sperm is alive, and the egg is alive, but now we have a diploid cell that's got the capacity to form an individual. Okay, thanks a lot. See you tomorrow morning. I guess 8 o'clock, I think it is, right?